Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on Dog Works Radio. You can join us over on dogworksradio.com and check us out on 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. And joining us from Southern California is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going today?
It's going great, Robert. We have moved the front of the race anyway out onto the Bering Coast, and almost everybody else is on their way up the Yukon River. So it looks like we are transitioning into the last third of the race, in the way that we talk about the race as being divided into approximately three more or less equal segments. So we're now on the Bering Coast. Nick Petit was the first into Unalakleet, stayed there for a few hours. Pete Kaiser, Jesse Royer, and Yor are pretty much running neck and neck, like less than a mile between the three of them. They stopped about 20 minutes before they got to Unalakleet and rested there, and it looks like they have all gone through Unalakleet without stopping and are chasing after Nick, who, as I'm looking at the tracker right now, it looks like he's about 15 miles in front. And so I think it's going to be really interesting. The weather is certainly going to play a large part in how this last third of the race goes. So.
Right. Unalakleet is the largest point in between Willow and Nome. There are direct flights in and out of there on a couple of different airlines. A lot of times fans will use that as a stopping point to catch some of the action on the trail. It's also the point where the pizzas can be delivered to the mushers at the checkpoint. And I know that we talked a little bit about that the other night when we were talking about Blair Braverman and her ugly dogs fans. And that took off like wildfire on Twitter. They really started talking about Peace on Earth Pizza and how folks could get pizzas out to the mushers in Nome. You know, I wonder if somebody calls up and orders a pizza for Lance Mackey, and then 10 people down the line call up for the same musher at the same time. I wonder if they make 10 pizzas or they say, hey, it's already been done. What do you think?
I would think that after the second one, they probably would tell people it's been done. And it's funny you mentioned Lance, because I was just talking to a friend of mine a little while ago who literally wants to have a pizza delivered to Lance when he gets in. And we were trying to figure out approximately when we think Lance is going to come in. And I did a sort of, you know, rough estimate. And I think he'll be into Unalakleet maybe by around noon tomorrow.
Excellent. So if you're interested in ordering pizzas for your mushers, check out Peace on Earth Pizzas. I believe they have a Facebook page. If not, I'm sure you can find them on the internet. And if you're listening, think about all of those mushers out there on the trail. I believe there's, 49 of them currently that may not get some of that love that the folks like Lance Mackey and Mitch Seavey and Ali Zirkle and all those folks that everybody knows about. They like pizza too, don't they?
They really do. And I just want to mention one more thing about the Blair's fans, the ugly dogs. Is a few days ago, there was apparently a tremendous percentage of the mushergrams that were being sent to Blair, and then some of the ugly dogs were being told by people in the phone room, you know, there's a lot of mushergrams being sent to Blair, and the ugly dogs on their own decided, oh, well, wait, we should spread some of this love around to the other mushers. And on Twitter, they sort of talked about and found out which mushers weren't getting as many mushergrams and made sure to publicize that so that the mushers who weren't getting the mushergrams could also get some when they came into checkpoints. And I just think that that's a remarkable thing as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about the coast. It is sort of that beginning of the third section of the race from Unalakleet on over to the next big checkpoint there in the race is White Mountain, where all of the mushers have to take a mandatory 8-hour rest. That's about 77 miles from Nome. Then they travel to Safety and the Safety Roadhouse, which is about 25 miles from Nome. And then they run pretty much along the beaches there and into the town of Nome and run along, what is it, Front Street, right? They run along Front Street. And it's a very interesting celebration when that happens. Can you describe that a little bit about as soon as the musher is sighted, what sort of goes on as they're working their way towards the finish line?
Yeah, so when the musher is, I believe it's approximately 2 miles out, there's a big fire siren that is sounded, and that lets everybody know that the musher is coming in, and they have somewhere around 10 or 15 minutes to get down to the Burled Arch, and especially very early in the race, when the first few mushers come in, everyone will sort of drop everything and go out to the Burled Arch to greet whoever is finishing. As you can imagine, that starts to drop off a little bit as more and more people come in. It's harder to get people to leave their warm beds in the middle of the night when people come in, but still, when you're watching the finish, you're watching either there's a webcam that's there, or the Iditarod Insider has coverage of people finishing. And no matter what time it is, you can always see people coming out and lining the chute and cheering in the people who come in. So it's a big party and a big celebration whenever someone finishes the Iditarod, and it's a very cool thing. And some of the people who have won Iditarod make a point of going out to greet every musher who comes in, or nearly every musher. And, you know, it's just a real achievement for anyone to be able to finish Iditarod. You know, and when we talk a little bit more about people who scratched, which I know we're going to do a little bit later in the show, it's a huge achievement for someone to be able to train and be able to run dogs well enough to complete their qualifiers. But, you know, anyone who – there's sometimes a feeling, especially among people who are newer to the sport, that there is something, you know, that there's something to be ashamed of, or that there's something wrong, or that you didn't do things right if you don't finish the Iditarod. And that's not always true. And I think that anyone who has run dogs will tell you that if you finish a race like the Iditarod or the Yukon Quest, that is a gigantic accomplishment. And it doesn't matter whether you finish in the top 10 or whether you are the Red Lantern. The fact that you have come these 1,000 miles and gone under the Burled Arch and finished this race is just an amazing achievement.
Right. And a little bit more about Nome. I was up there a couple of years ago, right about this time when about the middle of the packers were coming in. I didn't get there in time to see the winners come in. But when I was there, it was a pretty balmy week when I was there. I was walking around in a sweatshirt and there wasn't much snow, and you could go out onto the sea ice to the golf course and what they call the Nome National Forest and all that. But this year is a little bit different, isn't it? I know a lot of the Facebook fans that are trying to make their way up there were holed up in the airports last night. They couldn't get a flight out to Nome because they've had some historical weather out there the last couple of weeks, you know, throughout this winter. And I guess they had a pretty major blizzard these past couple of days. And it's really changing up the finish of the race, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And there's been just all up and down the coast, there's been a lot of wind. And I've seen some pictures of Nome in the past couple of days, and there's a tremendous amount of snow, and, you know, people with snow up to their shoulders. That's where channels have been, you know, carved out in the snow for people to walk around. At the same time, it's relatively warm there. It's in the 20s and 30s, as opposed to and a lot of times at the end of Iditarod, it's 30 degrees cooler than that in Nome. So it's going to be an interesting finish. I know that there flights were getting in today, but there were a lot of flights yesterday that weren't able to get into Nome, and a couple people I knew were on flights that were turned around and they had to come back to Anchorage and try to get out again today. I also just saw a photo that someone posted on Twitter of Unalakleet, and there was just no sea ice at all on the coast there. It was pretty much open water, and that's very unusual for Unalakleet. And I know that when they cross the Norton Sound later on, going up in from Shaktulik, that I believe they have had to reroute that trail so that it is much, much closer to the coast, or maybe following the coast all the way around, just because there is not the type of sea ice that we usually have there, and there's not the type of sea ice that is safe for dog teams to travel on.
Right. So let's jump over to our topic of the evening. We're going to talk a little bit about scratching in races, whether it be Iditarod or a qualifier or any race for that matter. But we're going to talk a little bit about first the three scratches that happened over the last 24 hours. A couple of them had scratched when we were on the air last night, but it wasn't official at that point. And then later in the evening, Cindy Abbott also scratched at Iditarod. What do you have on those three? Then we'll talk a little bit about the subject itself.
Yeah, so Emily Maxwell and Marcel Fresineau both scratched. They had not quite gotten into Iditarod. They were stopped, and they activated the emergency button on their tracker. There were a couple of people on snow machines who are not officially associated with the Iditarod, but they went out to do a welfare check and make sure that they were okay, wound up basically escorting them into the checkpoint, coming with them into the checkpoint, at which point they both scratched. So that was what people may recall is that the area, the 20 or 30 miles right before Iditarod, is where all of those frozen tussocks are. And that apparently is a very, very bad part of the trail these days, this year. And it was not good for the leaders. And then after the middle of the pack people had come through, the trail was really, really worn down. There were a lot of people who had problems with their sleds, who, you know, got their runners messed up or got the front of the sleds messed up. So I believe that is what happened with Marcel and Emily. And then overnight, Cindy Abbott, who was traveling with the three or four people at the very tail end of the pack, came into Iditarod, and she seems to have been resting there for a while and then made the decision to scratch. It said on the press release for Cindy when she scratched that she made the decision based on her own health and her ability to take care of her dogs. So I know that Cindy has some health problems and has a degenerative eye disease, and there may have been other issues that were related to that. I imagine we'll find out a little bit more in the next few days if that's something that she wants to share with people. But it seems that she felt that she could not continue and take care of her dogs in the way that she needed to take care of them. So, you know, Cindy's a friend of mine, and I like her a lot. And she had announced that this was going to be her last year running Iditarod. So I am, on the one hand, sad that she didn't get to complete the race, But on the other hand, I just find her an incredibly inspirational and very cool person and musher. She summited Mount Everest, and then a few months after climbing Mount Everest, she called up Lance Mackey and said, I want to learn how to mush dogs and run the Iditarod, and ran the first year with Lance's dogs. So she's just a great person, and we hope that she's doing well and wish her all the best.
So, Alex, I know you have some questions for me, and so we can get a little bit of a musher's perspective of this. I have scratched my fair share of times in races over the years, so I'm sure I can give a little bit of insight. But first, for relatively new fans, they need to understand a couple of things. First off, there is a big difference between a disqualification, a withdrawal, and a scratch. It's very difficult for a person to make that decision, first off. And, of course, the disqualification or withdrawal, usually that decision is made for you. And then, secondly, it's definitely part of a longer-term strategy on how somebody or where they're going to scratch, whether they're going to do it at a populated checkpoint or one that's not as populated. And I see that they're having a heck of a lot of problems there in Iditarod with all those tussocks beforehand. A lot of times, a lot of teams will scratch right there after the Dazzle Gorge and, you know, the Happy River Steps and all that. They'll just get beat up, and a lot of times you'll see teams scratch there. But before we get into the questions, it's a relatively good race in terms of teams that have scratched so far. We've only seen three, or are we at four right now, that have scratched
four
in the race? And it's typically about 10 or 15%. So we typically see many more scratches. Now, that could happen as we work our way down the trail, but it's a relatively good year in terms of people making it this far. Is that right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And we've had some years that have just been horrific in terms of the number of scratches. I think it was in perhaps 2013 when there were something in the neighborhood of 10 or 12 people who scratched right after the Dalzell Gorge.
Right. And that's right after that. I think it was the following year when everybody started wearing helmets, and one or two teams went out of the restart wearing hockey pads, and it was a real dangerous time. And a lot of that was equated to low snow years and ice and all that. And it was just a real dangerous proposition to go through that. And for fans that are listening, if you have not seen Jeff King's video about going through the gorge, and it may have been during that time in 2014, 2015 or so, that is a harrowing video to watch, and it is something that every Iditarod fan should at least watch one time. So, Alex, while we have some time, what questions do you have about scratching?
So, I think, first of all, when you've had the experience where you've scratched from races, is it the sort of thing where it's a gradual realization that things aren't going well, or is it that you get into one checkpoint, or you're on your way into one checkpoint, and a whole lot of things just start cascading and going wrong at once?
Typically, it is that cascade. And my last scratch was on the Kinnick 200, which is a qualifying race. And the goal is to make it, at that point, it was going from Big Lake to Willow and back. Big Lake, Yetna, Willow, and then back. And I was on my way back, and when I got to Willow, I soon found out that my drop bag with all of my extra food for the dogs, all of that extra stuff, went to Yetna instead of going to Willow. So I did not have the necessities that I needed for the rest of the race. And I got back on the trail and continued on, and I made some rookie mistakes. It was the middle of the afternoon, about 40 degrees in the middle of a swamp, and my team just pretty much shut down. And I remember sitting there on my cooler and trying to figure out, do I continue the 70 miles back, or do I turn around and go back to Willow, which was about 30 miles at that point? And it was a tough situation that I was in, because I didn't know quite what to do. And if you push that button, your race is over regardless. And that's what happened with Emily and Marcel, is as soon as you press that, and that's the difference between a scratch and a withdrawal or a DQ, that decision is made for you as soon as you press that button. So, yeah, it's one of those things that's very difficult to figure out if you're doing the right thing. And it's one of those situations where it's one of the toughest things that you will do as a dog musher, because a lot of times the dogs still want to go. You know, they're raring to go. They've got it programmed in their DNA that it's our job to run. And often the weakest link is the musher. And at that point, I guess it was me.
I'm wondering, like, what are the factors that you use when you're trying to figure out whether or not to scratch? Because I imagine that there's a large part of you that wants to, you know, to try to find a way that you can go forward. And I'm wondering what are those things that you weigh when you're trying to make that decision?
Well, the first one obviously is how much further do you have to go either to the next checkpoint or to finish the race. And being a qualifying race, you're typically finishing the race versus, you know, going up the trail 10 or 15 more checkpoints. Secondly, how are the dogs performing? And we've talked a lot about it on this show. If the dogs don't want to run, they're not going to run. And it's very difficult to make them run. And, you know, we've heard the stories about people getting off the sled and walking in front of the team. And, you know, eventually the dog saying, oh, hey, there goes our musher. We're going to jump on the back. Or we're going to run up to him and he'll jump on the back and then continue on. There's also other factors like, what's the trail like ahead? You know, do we have equipment problems? Do we have enough food to push forward? Do we have enough energy in our stores as the human part of the team? You know, what does it look like going forward, and should we do it now? And it's very difficult to weigh all those decisions when you're dealing with sleep deprivation and possible dehydration and lack of food or all those things that come into play. And when you're sitting there, it's tough to make that decision and whether you're going to do it, go forward or not.
And do you consult with other people? I mean, I know it probably depends on who else is around, but do you ask other people's opinions, either other mushers or race officials, when you're trying to make that decision?
That's a great question, and it came to another scratch. It happened to be in the same year as the Kinnick scratch. I was doing the Tustamina 200 down in on the peninsula here in Alaska, and it was the toughest 100 miles I've ever done in my life on a dog sled. And I remember pulling into the halfway point, which is in Homer, and I told the checker, I think I'm going to scratch. And, you know, I don't think I can continue. I don't have any good leaders. And, you know, I'm not used to all these mountains. And standing right next to the checker was Vern Halter, Cindy Abbott's mentor and business partner. And it's interesting how they're kind of intertwined here. And he pulled me aside there at the checkpoint. And he said, Robert, don't make a decision now. Feed your dogs. Let them rest. Do a good 6 or 8 hours here. Get some rest yourself. And then make a decision at that point. And that's exactly what I did. I thought about it, tried to figure out what was best, and I saw how the dogs were acting after the big meal, and they probably could have continued, but I don't know if I was ready to continue going up and down all those mountains. I wasn't in the shape to do that. So that consultation with Vern Halter really helped me out there, because I think I would have just thrown in the towel as soon as I checked into the checkpoint.
Right. And one final question. Once you decide that, once you make that final decision that you're going to check, that you're going to scratch, is there some relief at having made that decision?
For me, no. For me, it's been kind of a difficult ride afterwards, because you're putting so much into this, and I can only imagine what they're doing on Iditarod, especially if they're making it as far as these three ladies had. They're at the halfway point. And they're making that difficult decision and, you know, kind of throwing in the towel on their race. For me, it's one of the toughest things that you sort of go through. And it takes a long time to process, because you've put everything into this, whether it be, you know, a 1,000-mile race or qualifying for Iditarod or Yukon Quest or whatever. and to see those hopes and dreams and all that kind of dashed in just a moment because you made that decision. It's something that you're going to live with for a long time. And a couple of things I do want to add, and I know we're going to go over on time because of this. The first thing I want to add is when you do scratch, especially if you press your button and you're in between checkpoints, a lot of times you will mush the dogs either to the next checkpoint or the one that you just left, you know, kind of in that you're going to either go to point A or point B. But sometimes if you're in a real bad way, especially if your dogs have quit on you, the sort of the cavalry will be called out. And that's sort of what happened, I believe, with Emily and Marcel, is folks will come out and they will load your dogs up in dog boxes and kind of run them in the snow machine and kind of give you a relief. And you'll jump on the snow machine or whatever to get into the checkpoint on your own, and they will help you get in. That's never happened with me, but I know it's happened in the past, especially with dog teams that quit. And the last thing I want to mention is almost always we will see the reason for a scratch is for the health and benefit of the dogs. And I agree with that statement. I think that everything that you do sort of goes back to the health and benefit of your dogs. And a lot of people will praise that and say, I'm glad you did right by the dogs. And of course, that is the right thing to say. But typically, unless the dogs quit, it's the musher that's having the problems. It's them who are either sick, injured, tired, whatever. They're the ones that are unable to continue. And of course, that goes right back to them being able to take care of the dogs. And I'm thinking about a few years ago with Lance Mackey and all the trouble he was having with his hands, and he was having a heck of a time when it was 50 below, and his brother Jason stepped in and really helped him out during the rest of the race. I think it was well more than half of the race. And, his brother stepped in and helped him out so he wouldn't have to scratch. And I believe they finished together, pretty much coming into Nome within just a few minutes or maybe an hour or so apart. And that was because he had that help out on the trail.
Right. And, you know, we've sort of been spoiled a little with social media that we as fans and we as, you know, armchair mushers have been trained to think that we are entitled to know everything. That we're, you know, when someone scratches, we're entitled to know the full story. We're entitled to know exactly what happened. And I just want to make the point that we're actually not entitled to that. A lot of times,
right.
Mushers or their kennels will share what happened and will share the reasons and will provide more details. Sometimes that takes a few days. Sometimes people need time to process exactly what happened and feel like they can explain it in a way that will make sense to other people. And sometimes there is no explanation at all. And I think that I think that it's unfair of us as fans to be demanding of having more information. If someone wants to give more information, that's always welcome. But I think there's kind of this attitude that's developed in the past few years of fans that they are entitled to this. And I do not agree with that.
You know, we've said it several times on the show over the years that social media is a blessing and a curse for dog mushing and in Iditarod in particular, because the fans are just so passionate about it. They expect everything to be told to them because it's not like watching football or baseball or something you can watch in real time and get immediate results from. You know, this guy got tackled, this guy threw a touchdown. You know, this team scored a point, whatever. It's not the same thing in terms of access. And I think that, a lot of times there are decisions that are made out there on the trail that don't deserve any commentary. And I think that that fans of the sport need to recognize that they should not have to be told everything. Just enjoy the sport for what it is. I know everybody's passionate about their teams, their mushers, their fans, their dogs, whatever. But if a team is struggling out there and they do scratch, it was for a reason, and it was one that they did not take lightly. And I can almost guarantee that. I don't think anybody goes into any race and they say, okay, I'm going to go halfway and, you know, I did what I had to do and I'm just going to scratch here halfway. My dogs did what they had to do or whatever. It just doesn't work that way, of course.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons why people who are mushers or people who have been around the mushing community, when someone scratches, they are usually very, very quick to support the musher in that decision. Because for most people, you know, especially other mushers, they've been in that situation themselves, and they know that the last thing that someone needs is to have someone who's never been on the back of a dog sled criticizing them for something that they did or didn't do, you know, in the middle of a race.
If I could make one more point on that, is on that kind of going back and forth, especially from a fan's perspective, what kind of gets under my skin is when people say there's always next year. And I just don't like when people say that, because they're kind of dismissing it at that point. They're saying, oh, well, you know, John Smith, there's always next year to run Iditarod. There's always next year to run the Yukon Quest. There may not be. And you had talked about Cindy and Marcel, who had both made it known going into this year's Iditarod that this was going to be their last race. They're going to hang up the harnesses, so to speak. And when somebody just sort of dismisses it and says, there's always next year, I just don't like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think it's something that people say because it seems supportive, but it also really minimizes all of the hard work and effort and expense and time commitment that goes into entering a race like this.
Right. Okay. So Alex, we are way over time here. We're going to talk a little bit about a rookie musher, but not a rookie Iditarod musher, but not a rookie by any stretch. Ed Hopkins. Is that right?
Right. So Ed Hopkins of Tagish Lake Kennels is 54 years old and he has never run Iditarod before. So he is running as a rookie, but he has done almost everything else that you could do without having run Iditarod. He is kennel partners with Michelle Phillips. They run Tagish Lake Kennels together. He has been mushing since 1986, and he first became interested in mushing after he watched the finish of the first Yukon Quest in Whitehorse, and then he started handling dogs for musher Harry Sutherland. And after a few years of trying to put together his own team, he was a handler for Susan Butcher for two seasons and ran her yearlings in the Yukon Quest in 1993 and 1994. He's run the Quest 10 times and has earned the Yukon Quest Sportsmanship Award several times. He finished in third place in 2015. And has several other top five finishes. He's also run the Percy DeWolf race 12 times and has won it twice in 1999 and 2007. He won the Caledonia Classic 200 and has finished way up in the top in the races like the Klondike 300, the Copper Basin, the Kobuk 440, as well as the Yukon Quest 300, which is the shorter Yukon Quest race. He said that one of the things that he's known for is dog care. He received the Humanitarian Award in the Kubuk 440 Sportsmanship Award in the Yukon Quest, and has been awarded the Sportsmanship Award three times in the Percy DeWolf race, as well as the Humane Society Award, the Vet's Choice Award. And his team, which is also Michelle Phillips' team, has already completed the Yukon Quest this year. Nine of his dogs ran both the Quest and are running Iditarod, and that's true not only in this year, but the previous 2 years as well. Traditionally, what's happened is Ed would run the Yukon Quest, and then Michelle, with most of the same dogs, would run the Iditarod. And he said that, you know, eventually you just get the itch. And this year he just got the itch that he wanted to run the Iditarod. And so while he's a rookie being on the runners and running this race, he has been very involved in Iditarod in the past, both as a handler for Michelle's team. He's also been a race volunteer and has been up the trail doing work on the actual Iditarod in various checkpoints. And he said that he just wanted to run Iditarod while he still can. So there have been a lot of reports this year that there are a lot of moose on the trail. And he announced before the race that he was bringing an air horn with him so that if there were moose that he could sound the air horn and scare them away. And he has a team that he described as a really good mix of power and speed, including six dogs who can run well in lead. And his favorite lead dog that he has is Dragon, whom he describes as his little black furball of a dog. And Michelle Phillips said that she has run the Yukon Quest as well, but hasn't in a few years. And she decided that she wanted to return to the Yukon Quest this year. And Ed, who had been running the Quest, said, well, let's just switch it up and I'll run the Iditarod and you run the Yukon Quest. And Michelle Phillips said that it was knowing Ed that first drew her into mushing. And once she started, she helped him with the Yukon Quest and then decided that she was going to run her own teams and start entering races. And she now has 21 years of mushing experience, including six Yukon Quests and nine Iditarods. The Yukon Quest, as we know, is a very different race from Iditarod. They're both 1,000-milers, but the Quest has a lot fewer checkpoints that tend to be a lot farther apart. There's a lot more elevation work, elevation gain in the Yukon Quest. It's sometimes considered a much more difficult race technically, whereas the Iditarod is a much more popular race and there are a lot more checkpoints, and it's really considered kind of the Super Bowl or the Olympics of mushing. And Ed announced that he wanted to take his 24 in Takotna, where he had worked for several years as a volunteer at that checkpoint. And this year, Michelle also has taken her 24s in Takotna a lot over the years. And this year, Michelle Phillips was a race volunteer and was in the Takotna checkpoint. And after Ed completed his 24, when he was getting ready to leave, Michelle had to hide from Dragon, the lead dog, because Dragon was going towards her and was like, well, you usually take us out of here and I'm not sure what to do if you're here. So she actually had to hide when he was leaving and going back on the trail. And he said that he has 9 dogs with him out of his 14 that started who have run both the Quest and the Iditarod in the past few years. And there is a great video from KTVA that people can find, and we'll probably put it on the show notes, of Ed coming into the checkpoint of Anvik, and he signed a drawing of himself that one of the kids in the village had done. And he's a guy who has curly hair and a very distinct mustache, and someone had drawn this picture of him with the curly hair and the mustache, and he was signing it. He is, you know, doing well in the Quest does not always translate into doing well in Iditarod, and we've seen a lot of people who are phenomenal racers in one race who aren't able to quite do nearly as well in the other one. But he's doing very well. He is at the moment the second highest ranking rookie. He's in 34th place on his way into Caltag right now, and just seems to be running a very, very good, very respectable middle of the pack race. So it's exciting to have someone who is such an experienced musher, but has never run Iditarod, finally tackling Iditarod as a race. And I think he's going to do very well. And there's a very good chance he could even get the Rookie of the Year award.
A couple of quick things as you were talking that I was thinking about. The first thing is the Jim Lanier story in this year's Yukon Quest. And I believe he was a rookie in that race as well. And he was running that at, 77, 78 years old, something like that. And that's just a very interesting testament to the sport of mushing and just how tough that guy is. And then in comparison with Ed Hopkins, with all that experience on trail and finally running Iditarod after all these years and being considered a rookie. And I believe he said that the rookie jinx or something like that was grabbing a hold of him, but he knew how to deal with that. And he was quoted by saying that, and he was going to kind of cast those demons aside, I guess, and continue on down the trail. But, you know, more than anything, Alex, I think that this really is a great comparison of what happens that we talked about earlier with what happens when couples are trying to do the same race or entering two teams from a kennel in the race. And there may not be enough dogs to support those two teams, those B teams or puppy teams or whatever. So they combine their forces and have one sort of A team or mega team that they can really support and do well with. And I think that that's what Michelle and Ed are doing. Again, I'm not sure 100%, but I can only imagine that's the reason why they are, you know, running one team in this race versus a team and maybe a puppy team with him as the rookie. So I do wish them well out there. As you mentioned, they're very popular in the Quest circles. They live right there near Whitehorse. So, you know, they're very, very well attended at most of those events. And, you know, that's sort of their hometown race when they run the Yukon Quest. So I wish Ed the most, and I hope he does very well. And maybe he can get up there and be Rookie of the Year. That would be an interesting award for him with all this experience for sure. Alex, we have about 2 minutes left before our recording cuts off. Anything in closing?
No, I just wanted to mention that, you know, Ed and Michelle have about 60 dogs. And one might think, well, if you have 60 dogs, it might not be that difficult to get 28 dogs that are competitive. But as you know, the dogs are different ages. The dogs are different stages of their development. And, you know, even though there are fewer dogs on the teams this year, the difference between having 14 dogs who are just completely raring and ready to go and then trying to have another team of 14 dogs that are completely raring to go, it's a very difficult thing, even in a kennel of that size.
It is. It's something you train for many years. You know, you have that going into it. And I'm thinking of teams like Martin Boosser or Dallas Seavey, where they'll enter two or three teams in the race. And that's a strategy of their kennel, is to be able to produce multiple teams like that. Alex, it's a pleasure as always. I will talk to you tomorrow and we'll see what happens. We have about, 48 to 60 hours or so left in this race before somebody crosses under the arch. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.